I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the history of American civil unrest, 1967's wave of so-called race riots that occurred in cities around the country became known as the Long Hot Summer. Today we'll hear about a project that 50 years later looks not only at the causes, effects, and meanings of that unrest, but at the lessons today students can learn from it. Then, for those who've struggled to grasp the work of William Shakespeare, a veteran British director and acting teacher offers his advice for understanding the Bard's sonnets. He'll also offer a critique of my reading from Hamlet. We'll wrap with a live version of State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Fifty years after the long, hot summer of 1967, the causes, effects, and meanings of the riots that killed dozens and injured thousands in Detroit, Newark, and elsewhere are still debated. A group of 30 high school students will gather this summer on the University of Kansas campus to ponder those questions and to plan how to teach the subject. The topic is especially relevant in light of recent episodes of civil unrest in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and the ongoing Black Lives Matter movement. The National Endowment for the Humanities agreed, giving the Langston Hughes Center at KU a $180,000 grant to support teaching the long, hot summer of 1967 and beyond. With us today to talk about this project, Sean Alexander is director of the Langston Hughes Center. And Sean, good morning.
Good morning.
Clarence Lang is a professor of African and African-American studies at KU. And Clarence, nice to have you, too.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's bring this home to Kansas City, gentlemen, right out of the gate here. How much of a problem with unrest did this community have in 1967, or did it take the King assassination the following year for this town to ignite, Sean?
It took the King assassination the following year in 1968, following the assassination, unlike other cities, where the assassination sparked unrest in numerous cities throughout the country. Kansas City didn't respond until the day of the funeral on April 8th or April 9th when they were having the funeral. Many cities around the country let schools out, kind of a day of remembrance, and Kansas City did not do that. And there was a protest in response to that that went to City Hall, and the police responded with violence, and it sparked civil unrest here in Kansas City.
Oh, why didn't schools let out to honor someone like Martin Luther King?
Well, that's a good question. That's the question that everyone was asking at the moment. They thought that the city officials would recognize the importance of the day, and they just failed to do that. And the city civil rights activists, the NAACP, and other groups responded in kind and had a protest, and just ended up at City Hall to voice their opinion, and police came out with riot gear and ultimately fired tear gas into the group.
Huh. I was going to say, Clarence, tell us a little bit more about what happened here. How violent did things get?
Well, I can speak to the national narrative more so that, 1968 becomes a high point in the disturbances that happen around the nation in major metropolitan areas and even some mid-sized cities where you had a significant black population. So you have a coming together other frustrations that are ignited by instances of police brutality, but actually reflect longstanding grievances around employment, housing, education, the responsiveness of city government to these kinds of municipal needs. And so the assassination of King brings all these things. It's in some ways it's kind of the fuel on a fire that had already been simmering.
And the description you're giving here doesn't sound all that different from what this country's been going through in recent months, recent years.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we'll be exploring through this institute is the continuity. We would, of course, want to be careful about arguing that 1967 is the same as 2017. There are obvious differences. But there are some really striking parallels in terms of the longstanding grievances around the very same quality of life issues having to do with economic opportunity, social opportunity, political inclusion, and basic questions of citizenship.
So if that's the case, then what are the differences? How is 1967-68 different from 2017?
So, this becomes a question. I mean, I think we're on the other side, for example, of an African-American president, which some folks would have thought might have signaled a substantive change in issues of race in the United States. We're in a situation also where we have in many cities mayors, council people, other leaders who are elected officials who are African-American, which reflects in some ways some of the successes of that period.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have these deep-rooted kinds of issues of inequality. And so even as you're able to change the players in some ways, if we think about the conditions for what I would call the Black working class majority, those changes have been measured. And so you can change who's at the top, but in terms of how the average person is experiencing opportunity or not, as the case may be, we see that there's still a number of issues to be addressed.
You know, Sean, it's difficult to listen to Clarence and not walk away discouraged by what we're hearing here. I mean, this is tough stuff, and not surprising stuff, but tough nonetheless.
It's not surprising. Probably flipping you back to me is probably not the best, as my colleague would say. I'm probably the biggest skeptic out there, but no, it is. I mean, it's a frustrating thing, and the frustrating thing is, in response to the urban unrest that occurs, and we can go back to much earlier, but really, let's say starting in 64, 65, 66, then culminating in 67 and 68, we have a number of unrests happening, and they begin to look at it. They look at police brutality. They look at economic issues, the same issues that Clarence is talking about. But the thing that's so frustrating over and over is everyone recognizes it. They say, we see the problems, but they do not do any action, or the policy differences are very minimal. And that's where we sit today. We still are wrestling with, what are we going to do in policies?
Mm-hmm.
That we have, when we have the Kerner Commission, which is drawn up in 67, actually when Detroit is happening,
In response to the riots, yeah.
It's more of a response to what happens in 64, 65, and 66. Johnson, when Detroit, in the late July, when Detroit uprising is happening, Johnson's signing that order. So it's not actually a response often, as everyone says, to the 67 riots. It's happening, although Newark happens a little bit before, a couple weeks before Detroit. He's wanting to know why this trend is here, right? But when Kerner, the commission reissues their conclusions, Johnson ignores it for the most part, right? And then you have Fred Harris, a member of the commission, coming out in 30 years later, writing a book called Quiet Riots, where he says nothing has changed.
Well, help me here, though. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, we're talking about the tail end of his administration. And this is an administration highlighted, obviously, by Vietnam, but also domestically by his Great Society proposals and a focus on housing and voting rights and poverty, the war on poverty that began under Lyndon Johnson more than 50 years ago now. So if all those internal domestic initiatives are underway then, Clarence, help me understand why so much unrest at the end of Johnson's administration after so much progress, some would say, on some of the issues you're describing here.
There is progress, but and I don't know if Sean would agree or disagree, but, I would argue that in some ways the Great Society, otherwise known as the War on Poverty, many of the programs were anti-poverty driven, in some ways succumbed to the war in Vietnam. And so while the Johnson administration was very effective in getting some significant pieces of legislation passed, resources increasingly went to the war in Vietnam. And so you could not wage those two wars, if you will, at the same time, and not without the kinds of sacrifices that it would take. And so part of Johnson's failure, I would say, and I think that over the course of time, in terms of the U.S. presidency, he fares pretty well, I think, increasingly, if we think about where we are now. But, he never, I think, leveled with the public about what it would take. First of all, the desirability of both a war in Vietnam and a domestic war against poverty. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, the resources went to the war in Vietnam. And this was it became part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s critique of the Johnson administration and thus the need for the Poor People's Campaign that he was organizing to go to D.C. at the time that he was assassinated in Memphis.
But still, it's remarkable, Sean. We haven't seen an American president focused domestically with the laser focus of Lyndon Johnson, I don't think, ever since.
No, I would completely agree. But I think the problem is as Clarence is pointing out, is the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I think you see that with King's reaction, but taking it into a political scope as well, Bobby Kennedy's mm-hmm. reaction. Right. Kennedy is saying we need to focus on poverty more. He's running the same line that King is running. So you've got to understand that there's the critique within what we call today the left or within the Democratic Party as well. So we can hang our hat on Johnson and say you're doing this stuff. But even within his party, they're saying you're not doing enough.
So I gather that when the teachers gather this summer on the campus of KU, it's these kinds of issues you guys are going to be trying to lay out here, because this is tough stuff. I mean, there's a lot of things to wrap your arms around here.
I mean, yes, and including language, because one of the things that we want to problematize is how we even describe the phenomenon, because for some folks, whether you call it riot,
I was going to ask you about
rebellion,
this. Yeah.
Disturbance, uprising, these things are very freighted. I think
the word riot particularly is freighted and or loaded, because why?
Well, there's a sense that it refers to kind of incoherent, misdirected, undirected rage. I think I can speak perhaps for Sean and myself that you know, whatever the term, we understand these as political phenomenon. But nonetheless, we have to work through the conversation, because the terms that we use in some ways can help frame the conversation.
Well, were these riots by and large across the country? My sense from watching the video last night and looking at photographs, I was born in Detroit, left before the riots, but certainly watched very closely, was this was disorganized, or am I wrong?
Well, I mean, I think that they were spontaneous.
Okay.
But when I say I would describe them as political phenomenon, it wasn't just simply people running amok, but that there were long-standing grievances about policy or a lack of policy that was underlying them. And I think that if we don't understand that, then the conversation never comes back to, as Sean was, you know, the issue of policy, that these weren't just things that just came out of thin air, that they reflected long-standing concerns and grievances about the trajectory of social policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became easy, if you call them riots and described them as criminal activity, then it took the onus off having to deal with the fact that we needed reformist policies to address the circumstances that
it
were
It distracts us from the fact there were big problems that needed to be addressed.
Absolutely.
Is what you're saying.
That's
yeah.
the point.
Yeah,
you
know,
every one of these incidences are happening because of police brutality, police response, because of the segregation, because of housing policies, all of those issues. So by saying they're riots, it does move you off. It's no different than what we've seen in recent years with Ferguson and Baltimore, by saying, well, they're looting their own communities. They're not paying attention to what's actually going on. More importantly, historically, we miss the idea of what a race riot is. Mm-hmm. Race riot historically was the white community attacking the black community.
Ah.
And that term had been changed by the 1960s because African Americans began to rise up in urban rebellions. And we began to label them as race riots. It's not a race riot. It's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we can go back to numerous times in the country, throughout the country, that we have these race riots. More importantly, I think the idea of a riot, we forget in our country, our nation was founded on a riot,
right?
The Boston Tea Party. We simply call it the party.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a riot.
Well, it wasn't really a party.
No, it's a riot. It's an attack on
a
ship.
Not how we think about it today.
They're looting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, they're dressing like Native Americans. So it's racialized.
Huh.
In that riot, right?
Yeah.
But we celebrate that.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about a new program that'll be offered this summer over at KU that'll focus on the long, hot summer of 1967. I'm visiting with Sean Alexander, Clarence Lang, both involved with this project. But before I forget, so Sean, where was the focus of the unrest in Kansas City? What happened here?
What happened here is really that there is a march down to City Hall. During that response, once they finally get to City Hall and the police try to squash what's going on in the demonstration in front of City Hall, they clash with the individuals. And the individuals there believe it's an over zealous response by the police, and it leads into ultimate unrest. And over 100 people are arrested, 5 people die.
Are there riots then here, or whatever you want to call it?
I would call it a disturbance if we're going to use those terms.
Are buildings burned?
No. It's more than an uprising. It's not an uprising the same way I would say Newark is, or Detroit, or even Wichita happens in 67 and 68. This is a moment in time, and I would call it a disturbance, if we will. Or, you know, you could do the uprising with the idea.
But not as dramatic as Detroit, Newark, Wichita, other cities.
Exactly.
So are the high school teachers who are coming here, are they all from Kansas? Are they from around the country? Clarence, what do you see?
We've got a good collection of people coming from all around.
All over the place.
Around the nation. Yeah, absolutely.
Can somebody still get in if they're listening to this right now? Or you
I'm
booked.
Afraid not, probably not.
Yeah. You're limiting it to 30.
Yeah.
Probably. Limiting it to 30, and the applications were due a while ago. The NEH has a process to do that. But I encourage them to get out there and look for other events that are happening with the NEH-funded events, whether things are happening in the fall or following summer. NEH does these type of institutes throughout the country every year for teachers.
And teachers are interested in this period of time. Is it the anniversary that has sparked the interest? Is it Ferguson? What's driving this?
I think it's both. I think that definitely, I mean, this is a kind of a milestone if we think about anniversaries. But I think that, you know, our sense is that there are a lot of teachers who are trying to figure out, in light of Ferguson, Baltimore, and what have you, Milwaukee, how to teach this kind of material in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
How do you teach about social inequalities? How do you teach about responses to that? How do you teach about race relations? How do you teach about socioeconomic issues that still
plague us. So are you providing teachers with a lesson plan, or is it up to the teachers to get educated and then sort of figure out where they want to go with this information?
Yeah, what the idea is that it's an intense 3 weeks. They're here for 3 weeks.
You're going to work them. Your face. You're going to go after them.
We're going to work them. Working pretty hard. Intense reading materials. But their ultimate goal is to create their own lesson plans and us to work through that material with them to try to create lesson plans that they can take back to their classrooms and collaborate amongst themselves, because we've got people, as Clarence said, from all over the country. So we've got people from Kansas, from Kansas City even. We've got people from Florida, from Mississippi, from Maine.
And obviously you've got teachers who are younger than people like me who don't maybe know a whole lot about this because this came before they were even on this planet.
Absolutely. We've got some teachers that are in their 20s, right? So they don't even, you know, consciously remember the Berlin Wall.
Yeah. Can you believe that, Clarence?
I was just going to say, just really quickly, I mean, just sort of back to the issue of walking away discouraged. I actually think that we're at a very hopeful moment. I think if we compare this moment to, for example, the 1990s, where people were struggling to create organized social activity, I mean, I think that even though it came out of tragedy, I mean, I think that the things that we've seen coming out of Florida behind the George Zimmerman verdict and the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Ferguson, Baltimore, that there's organized opposition, critique of the status quo. And I think that anytime you have that kind of contestation, which I think is very similar to the 1960s in this regard, there are some positive things that can come out of that conflict.
Meaning race, economic inequality, those issues are more at the forefront today than they've been in quite some time.
That's my argument. And there are a lot of young people who've been organizing around that, whether we're talking about the Occupy movement or Black Lives Matter, for example.
And I would add that it's not just those organizations, the young people, it's also firing up some of the old organizations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The NAACP has been extremely active. They've always been active. They're over 100 years old. But the LDF, the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, continues to fight and continues to win on voting rights cases throughout the country.
Right.
And it's heartening to see that there's kind of a fight and a pushback.
I'm going to just touch just quickly, gentlemen, on the Kerner Commission that was formed in response to some of this. The commission had a famous conclusion that even I recognize this quote. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And yet, bottom line, the commission's report overlooked by and large, Clarence.
Yes, and you know,
powerful words.
It is, yeah, they are, and I think
in
some ways it's there's still truth in that. But I think we do ourselves a disservice if we don't recognize that The question is, you know, what happens when progress occurs, right? Because I lived through a period where many of the gains of that period since are being rolled back. But you can't roll back something that didn't proceed in the first place, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you can't you can't have a backlash against a success that doesn't exist. And so I think we have to keep in mind that there's that kind of push and pull of human society where there are steps taken forward and there's some taken back, but people keep pushing. And that's the point.
And I would add just really quickly as well that I think oftentimes in racial instances, especially if we're talking in the binary of black and white, we talk about progress by only looking at a few black individuals and think that the black community is monolithic. Mm-hmm. So if you see an Oprah Winfrey, you see Barack Obama becoming the president, you say race relations are perfectly fine and we've overcome things, but you're not actually looking at the deep problems within the community at large. The way that we look at poverty in the United States in a general way, right, not racialized, we see a problem with poverty in the United States. But mm-hmm. when we talk about the black community, we will come back and say, well, what you have an Oprah Winfrey, you have a Barack Obama, you have a Michael Jordan.
Just a final point. How do you help teachers overcome maybe a natural fear of talking about race, economic inequality in the classroom? Because, you know, newspapers are full of stories of teachers who got in trouble for misspeaking or stumbling and saying the wrong thing, being culturally insensitive, when, in fact, these are issues that arguably need to be approached directly in classrooms everywhere these days.
Well, I think the key, and this is the work that I would like to say that we're doing, is it's about preparation, that good intentions are good, but I think it pays to have done your homework before.
You got to get ready for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what we're looking forward to seeing happen.
The Summer Institute, Teaching the Long Hot Summer of 67 and Beyond, starts on June 11th. It runs through July 1st. More information, if you're curious about this, summer67.ku.edu. More information there. I want to thank my two very good guests here, Sean Alexander, director of the Langston Hughes Center over at KU, Clarence Lang, a professor of African and African-American Studies at KU. Good luck with your project. Thanks for coming in today, guys.
Thank you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, I'm going to get schooled on how to speak Hamlet the right way. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we learned how gender bias has affected years of science. We also explored the creative process of Kansas City performing arts group Quixotic. Find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll get a sneak peek at the new Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center just before its public opening on Saturday. That's tomorrow. On the show. Well, veteran British director and master acting teacher Ian Wooldridge has helmeted more than 100 stage productions, including The Tempest and A Midsummer's Night's Dream for Kansas City's Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. In conjunction with the festival's 25th anniversary, the former dean of the British American Drama Academy is going to share insights from his years of training students to walk and talk the words of the world's greatest dramatist. Today, the esteemed director has the distinct honor of coaching me through a few lines from Hamlet, and that's going to be a hoot. And Ian, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be back in Kansas City.
So what's the most common issue you deal with, Ian, when it comes to teaching newbies how to navigate Shakespeare?
Well, it depends on how old they are. I'm a great believer in throwing acting students in at the deep end. And in a way, the younger they attempt Shakespeare, the better, because they have what I call the confidence of ignorance. They don't know how difficult it is. And so they just get on with it and do it. I suppose, you know, language is a problem in the sense that he had between 20 and 25,000 words in his lexicon. Milton, the man who wrote Paradise Lost, had 8,000. You and I probably have about four.
Five
times as many words as we do. I mean, he invented the English language. So it's a question of will they understand
25,000 words at his disposal, that's just breathtaking.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, he had a lot of words, and therefore it's a question of will they understand it. You know, but of course, the answer to that is if the actor understands it, so will the audience.
I was going to say you're taking the words out of my mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
The actor's got to understand where
sure.
he or she's coming from.
Absolutely.
Not to get off too far afield here, but Shakespeare, was he one guy? Yes, talk about one man, 25,000 words. You hear these different stories about.
No, I believe so, and I believe that he was the son of a glove maker from Stratford-on-Avon, and a pure genius. And you know, he knew about things that were going on at court. He knew about the monarchy, but he also knew about ordinary people, and he appealed to all sections of society. You know, the aristocrats and the groundlings.
So you get people, the actors, over the hump of understanding how. What's your process?
Well, I think, you know, the thing about actors today is because of all the internet and Google and, you know, dictionaries, finding out what it means is the easiest thing. You're at first base already. But if you're going to hit a home run, you have to learn to commit to language that you wouldn't normally use. So a lot of the language is alien. I mean, take a word like toil, for instance, T-O-I-L. Now, you probably know what it means. I know what it means. Most people out there know what it means. But how often do we use it?
That's right.
You know, we don't say we're off to toil today. Mm-hmm. We're off to work. So, you know, I mean, it's just as simple as that. You know, if you're going to use toil and convince me that it's part of your everyday speech, then you're going to have to commit to it and, you know, exercise your imagination on it. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge of Shakespeare.
Are you surprised at all, given this fast-paced society and attention spans that last, you know, a nanosecond, that Shakespeare remains the draw and remains as important as he is these days?
No, I'm not surprised, because I think you're talking about one of the greatest minds that ever lived. You know, a person who created iconic art forms like the Mona Lisa, you know, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet. You go up to the man or woman at the Kansas City bus stop. They've never seen these plays. They've never read them, but they know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're part of the collective subconscious of the English-speaking world.
That's amazing.
And they are, you know, as popular today as they ever were, because they are always reflecting society. They're always holding the mirror up to nature, telling the story of the people to the people.
You've said that American students can be very demanding, or at least you've said that over the years.
Mm.
Why?
I think they're very curious. I think they have, you know, demanding is a good word in terms of, you know, show me, tell me how to do it, all that. Give me solutions. Give me answers. Sometimes you have to encourage them to find those solutions for themselves.
On their own.
A question of, you know, telling them. They're not puppets. But it's about synthesizing what are historical characters through their own experience. So, I mean, if you're going to play one of the comedies like A Midsummer Night's Dream and you've been in love, then, you know, you're halfway there because you know what it's like. So you know how to play certain characters in that play. If you haven't, you have to imagine it. So it's about synthesizing, as I say, through your own experience.
And British students are different?
They're a little bit more on the back foot.
Meaning?
Well, American students, acting students, have a front foot energy, which I think is wonderful. And that's what Shakespeare requires. It requires great energy, both physical, emotional, intellectual, and verbal. You know, I mean, it's not naturalistic. It's highly stylized writing. And therefore, in order to deliver it, you know, in a passionate and vivid way, you have to get your tongue around it. And that isn't that easy. I mean, we're used to celluloid and mumbling, you know. Are you going to go to Burger King? Or are you going to go to McDonald's? You know, it's very low key. Whereas Shakespeare requires a kind of level of articulation and energy that we're not used to in everyday life.
Tell us about the audition tours that you do across this country and what it is you're looking for, Ian.
Well, I think what you're looking for, when I go into a room and in Los Angeles or, you know, Boston or Chicago or any of the other major cities, looking for courage.
I was going to say, that's the magic word for you is courage.
Courage, yeah.
That would be the first word I'd go to.
Ready to express themselves. No question, that's the word I'd use. You know, that people, you know, even if they get it wrong, the capacity to make choices, to make dynamic choices, to express the you-ness of themselves, the unique, their USP. I said to actors, what's your USP? What's your unique selling point? What makes you you? Because let's face it, the reason we go to theatre, the reason we go to the movies, it's to see people who we find fascinating, attractive, interesting, you know, sexy, whatever you want to say.
Hey, how many of every 10 actors you come across, how many of them have the courage you're looking for?
Well, there are three T's, aren't there, which is like a sporting analogy. Talent, they've probably got that. Tenacity, how badly do they want to do it? And temperament, you know, have they got the temperament? Have they got the personality to be an actor, to deal with rejection on a daily basis? So out of 10, out of any 10, it's hard to say. 3, 4 maybe?
Really?
Possibly eight, if they're an extraordinary bunch of people. Have they got the resilience? Have they got the survival techniques? Because it isn't easy.
Of being an actor and getting rejected so often, I mean, that is just fierce. I mean, that's just tough.
Well, you have to remember Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, okay? So Redford, what was he? Number four, number five on the list? They went to Nicholson. They went to whoever. For whatever reason, they turned it down. They couldn't do it. They weren't available. The money wasn't good enough. They didn't fancy the script. And eventually, you know, along comes Redford. Yeah. Or it might have been Newman. I'm not sure. But one of them, you know, wasn't number one. And very seldom are they number one.
J.K. Rowling was rejected the first Potter scripts.
That's right.
Amazing. Okay. Did you always enjoy Shakespeare?
Always. Yeah.
Why?
Well, I was introduced to it when I was quite young, as I say, and I was fortunate enough to go to school in Coventry in the Midlands of England. We were 18 miles away from Stratford, where they were doing the most wonderful productions of plays by Shakespeare. This is in the early 60s. I used to hitchhike over to Stratford, 18 miles away.
Even as a kid?
Yeah, even as a kid, like 12, 13 years old, and go and see Shakespeare done very, very well. So I was introduced to him, and I was fortunate enough to be at a school where we did Shakespeare. You know, every other year we did a Shakespeare play, you know, and I acted in Shakespeare. So I kind of, you know, I just dived in at the deep end.
How did you get past, at that point in your life, you don't have that much life experience, which strikes me as being so essential to really getting Shakespeare and being able to deliver it.
Absolutely. But as I said earlier, the confidence of ignorance, you know, you just just did it. You know, it's got in there.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
What was the hardest thing for you to overcome doing Shakespeare?
Well, I think the learning of it is not that difficult, funny enough, because, you know, the iambic pentameter, de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum, the meter of a line, the beat of a line, is the nearest thing in spoken English to the human heartbeat. So it's quite easy to learn. But I think it is that thing of, you know, knowing what it means, understanding and committing to it. Because when we speak in everyday life, we commit to what we're saying because we need to persuade people, convince people, impress people, whatever. So that, you know, it's about commitment to a language which is not your own necessarily.
I should point out that Ian Wooldridge will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. You'll be talking about what we're talking about here, some of this?
I'm going to be talking about Hamlet specifically, which is the production that opens next week by the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival.
I was going to say, the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival presents Hamlet Tuesdays through Sundays, June 13th through July 2nd. All performances begin at 7:30, just to the west of the Nelson Atkins Museum of
Art,
in that great park there. The Heart of America's production of Hamlet is an outdoor performance. What's different, you know, about staging an outdoor show, Ian? Is it harder or easier than a traditional indoor show?
Well, I think in many respects it replicates what the plays were written for in the first place, because, you know, the Globe is an outdoor theatre. It's open to the sky. And if you go to the Globe in London, then you've got the distractions of planes going overhead in today's modern age and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think it's a question of scale.
Mm-hmm.
Indoor theatres are often a little bit smaller, but outdoor theatres, you know, it has to be big. But you can be very big with Shakespeare and you could be truthful. It requires, in this modern age, you know, radio mics and all that kind of thing, which Heart of America has, so that, you know, they can all be heard. But it's about reaching the back of a large audience. And that's great. But it's lovely to play it to big audiences because that's what the plan was in the first place. I mean, the Globe in London holds 1,800 people. That's a lot of people.
It's hard to reach the back of the audience when there are so many words that got to be said here. That's exhausting, isn't it?
Well, it's demanding. It's the Olympics of theatre making. It represents the very peak, the very biggest challenge for actors, for directors, for designers, for everybody. Yeah.
Well, let's run a 100-yard dash, you and I, right here. I'm going to read a section from Polonius here. Do you want to set this up so our listeners have a sense of what I'm going to read? Very poorly, I might add, as you chew me up and spit me out here.
Yeah. Can you tell me what bit it is?
It's page 73. Does that get you anywhere? I don't know. I don't know these things.
Who's he talking to?
The king.
Right, okay.
And
why don't you read it?
Why don't I read a little bit and then you're going to tell me?
Yeah, sure.
This is Polonius. And I'm stalling for time here.
Yes.
It shall do well, but yet do I believe the origin and commencement of his grief sprung from neglected love. How now, Ophelia? You need not tell us what Lord Hamlet said. We heard it all. My lord, do as you please, but if you hold it fit, after the play, let his queen mother all alone entreat him to show his grief. Let her be round with him, and I'll be placed, so please you, in the ear of all their conference. If she find him not, to England send him, or confine him where your wisdom best shall think.
Very good.
That's Oh, come on.
No. It is very good.
I'm a natural?
No question.
Would you hire me?
Oh, definitely.
Yes, there we go.
Very good. I mean, here he is, a courtier. He loves being a courtier. He loves having the ear of the king, in this case, Claudius, who we now know killed his brother, Hamlet's father, in order to get the kingship. He's left his daughter, Ophelia, to be a kind of, you know, a stalking horse for Hamlet to find out whether Hamlet's mad or not. You know, and he thinks he has the answer to everything. And, you know, he's a natural schemer, is Polonius. I would say to you, take it a little bit slower.
Slower.
Observe the punctuation. And
punctuation?
And think, yes.
Now you're getting technical on me.
Full stops, you know, commas, or rather periods, as you say, and semicolons and all that. And also think about how you're going to persuade Claudius that you have the answer to, you know, his issues with Hamlet.
Okay, I'm going to do it again here.
Right, thank you.
It shall do well, but yet do I believe the origin and commencement of his grief sprung from neglected love. How now, Ophelia? You need not tell us what Lord Hamlet said. We heard it all. My lord, do as you please, but if you hold it fit, after the play, let his queen mother all alone entreat him to show his grief. Let her round with him, and I'll be placed, so please you, in the ear of all their conference. If she finds him not, to England send him, or confine him where your wisdom best shall think.
Very good.
A little better.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm getting there.
You're on the way.
I'm on the way.
Yeah.
Okay. Do people tend to go too fast when they first start with you?
A little bit, yes. I think the note you probably give to young actors more than any other is slow down. Take your time. You don't need to rush.
Yeah. How do people memorize all this stuff? I mean, some of the featured performers have reams and reams of stuff here, Ian. It's amazing to me.
Well,
I just get nervous watching them sometimes.
Each actor has their own method, you know. I mean, some of them tape it and listen to it before they go to sleep, or they wake up and miraculously they know it. Some of them work with
the play it all night while they're sleeping?
Well, it can be going on subliminally in their head. Some of them have photographic memories. They just look at it and they know it. Some of them go through it with friends. I mean, it is demanding stuff, no question. So what you're watching is people walking a tightrope, aren't you, when you go to see the theatre? You know, something, a live event. And they could at any moment fall off and calamity could happen.
And when they fall, you recommend what?
Well, they have to pick themselves and get back on the horse and carry on riding.
Get going, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's British director, master acting teacher Ian Woolridge. He'll be around and very much involved with the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival presenting Hamlet. It begins June 13th, Westmoreland Park. All performances begin at 7:30. And again, he speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Thanks for the lesson. What a pleasure to have you,
Ian. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very
much.
Good
to be back. Thank you.
Kansas lawmakers are trying to wrap up several big priorities like school funding and a tax bill. Things are moving fast in the legislature, so this week we're bringing you a live version of State House Blend Kansas. We're joined by KCUR Sam Zeff, and we've got Kansas Public Radio Stephen Caranda on the phone as well. Sam, always good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Stephen, good morning.
Hello there.
Well, last night, both the House and Senate passed a tax bill and school funding formula. Stephen, who are the winners and losers in the final bills here?
Might be a better question for Sam.
Sam, fire away.
Yeah, I can say the winners would be people who are interested in rolling back much of the 2012 tax cuts, because that's exactly what this bill does.
Hmm.
I think they're with the school finance piece. I think that the winners eventually is going to be picked by the state Supreme Court. There's $284 million going into public schools.
One big question is that enough money or not?
Well, educators are going to argue that it is not. There's actually $184 million new dollars in the first year. I think that legislative leaders believe that will be enough, along with a dedicated funding source of personal income tax would be enough to satisfy the state Supreme Court.
And
educators across the board believe that's not the case.
How about you, Sam? You've been following this issue for a long time. Any gut sense of whether that number will meet approval or not?
There was no specific number, of course, in the Gannon ruling, but there were some pretty significant hints. They relied greatly on the three-judge panel's ruling, and they've also there's also been figures put out by the State Department of Education that would suggest that a minimum of $400 million new dollars the first year would be what the Supreme Court is looking for.
Now, $400 million. You're saying this is $184 million,
right? I think they would certainly would accept less. One of the theories, of course, is if you just all of a sudden put an extra $400 million into the system, it would be difficult for school districts to spend all of that all at once. Let's say, for example, Blue Valley wanted to replace all the librarians that they got rid of. To be able to hire so many people in a short period of time would be difficult. So I think the Supreme Court will take that into mind, but I do believe that $184 million, the betting by educators and by the lawyers who represent the school districts, is that that's not enough.
Stephen, does this mean that the LLC business exemption is now finished? And there's a third tax bracket here, right?
Correct. This bill, this tax bill, what it did is created a new third tax bracket like we used to have and raised all the income tax rates, but not to the point where they were in 2012 before the tax cut. And what it also does is, as you mentioned, it gets rid of the business tax exemption. We have, you know, more than 300,000 business owners who are able to use this exemption in state law, so they don't have to pay state income taxes. And it also gets rid of what a lot of people call the glide path to zero. So there's a mechanism built into state law where income tax rates will go down over time based on a formula. It gets rid of that, too. So there are several things in here that would roll back the 2012 tax cuts, but as we know, Governor Brownback already said he will veto the plan, so it's not like this is a done deal.
Sam, before we get to the impact of Brownback's statement last night that he will veto this thing, as Stephen just pointed out, tell us a little bit more about the tax debate on the Senate floor last night. I understand it was pretty colorful at times.
Yeah, golly, Steve, I have to say that that it was colorful, at least interesting as well. The House had already passed the bill. It went over to the Senate, and they took it up, started debate probably around 11 p.m. Conservatives didn't like it. They don't like it. They think that it raises way too much in taxes. And you heard sort of the regular stuff. Senator Ty Masterson from Andover said that the state of Kansas was fixing to rob Kansans. Senator Rob Olson from Johnson County suggested that it's going to drive businesses out of Kansas and certainly wouldn't spur new business development. But I think the most interesting comment came from Senator Dennis Pyle. He is a Republican veteran state legislator from Hiawatha who equated the state of Kansas with Pharaoh and Kansas taxpayers with Jewish slaves in ancient Egypt, and it sort of and it went from there. And I don't know how much of that is just the Kansas legislature or maybe the Kansas legislature after dark, but it was certainly an interesting debate to listen to.
How late did this go last night, Sam?
They finally voted about 12:30 was about the time that that the final vote was passed. It was maybe an hour later that we got the statement from Governor Brownback that he was going to veto this. Budget Director Sean Sullivan hinted strongly. He was watching the debate on the floor last night. Hinted strongly to me that the governor was going to veto. He did not say it was going to happen at 1:30 in the morning.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're conducting a live version of State House Blend Kansas. I'm visiting with KCUR's Sam Zeff and Kansas Public Radio's Stephen Crand about all the activity in Kansas and Topeka as lawmakers struggle to wrap up this Herculean session of the legislature over there this year. Stephen, they've had all session to hash this thing out, and obviously they haven't been able to, at least up to this point. How did this manage to come together in just one night last night?
That's kind of what we've seen in recent years when they have big issues to tackle, is it is a legitimate strategy to use pressure to get people on board with things, and in this case, to finally say, okay, we'll run a tax bill that would probably get the moderates and the Democrats on board in the House, and that's what they did. The problem is, will this tax bill be big enough that there won't be enough votes for a veto override? As we know, a veto override on kind of a similar tax bill failed earlier in the session.
Barely failed, I should point out, yeah.
Correct, but this tax bill raises even more money, so you might be losing some additional votes from lawmakers who said, I was willing to veto override on that other one, but I'm not on this one. So it's really unclear how this is going to go. I just still have no idea when they might actually be able to wrap this up and what it'll look like when they do. I did see on Twitter a joke from a lawmaker saying if they don't override, there won't even need to be a special session because they'll just be here till July when the Supreme Court rules on the K-12 funding system.
I was going to say, Sam, there is this deadline looming out there of July 1st to get this new school funding formula squared away, the deadline set by the Kansas Supreme Court. If this thing is not met, what is the latest thinking about what that would mean for the start of school in August? Will there be a start of school? Do we know yet what this might mean? Where does all that shake out?
Well, there's actually a deadline before that, and that is probably June 18th. And that's when the state starts to do payroll for the following month. You'll recall we went through this last year that there will be talk of possible furloughs if they can't get a budget passed by the 18th. I also will say that last night before the debate in the House, that House leadership led by Speaker Ron Reichman was meeting with also legislative staff to try to figure out how to pay state lawmakers next week if the session bleeds over to them. Right now, there's no money to do that. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure that out last night. Will there be school in August? So the Supreme Court has set a June 30th deadline. The Supreme Court could also say, you know what, you guys are making a good faith effort. We understand that the work is ongoing, so we're not going to shut down public education on July 1st. The fear
before you move that deadline, you take a deadline away and trying to get a legislature of different factions to come together will be much more difficult.
It might be more difficult, but I don't think it would be an indefinite deadline. The real fear for educators now would be if the Supreme Court shuts down public education on June 30th. Most summer schools are done by then, but a lot of schools feed disadvantaged kids during the summer. There are some other programs there. Those would have to be shut down because the buildings couldn't operate. That right now is the immediate fear of educators across Kansas.
You know, Stephen, I'm wondering about this veto override, the possibility of one here. The suggestion so far has been it might be more difficult because this bill raises even more money. But I'm wondering if lawmakers, some lawmakers might be upset that the governor has came out so quickly and promised a veto here, if that might stimulate some to say, to heck with him, I'm going to change my vote and go ahead and vote to override here.
You know, that's a good point. We don't know exactly how people are reacting to that because it came when all of us were at home and a lot of lawmakers aren't here yet. So that could be the case. The governor said he was vetoing it so quickly so they could get started right away on something else, which is a valid point as well. So, you know, I don't know how that's going to shake out yet. Nerves are already, you know, frayed here. So I'm sure this veto, while some people expected it, is not helping the opinions of people here.
And this is such difficult stuff, Sam.
It's going to be very difficult. One quick point. They need one vote in the Senate, 15 votes in the House to override. The Senate may be, they may be able to get that vote, 15 votes in the House, so it's going to be a heavy lift.
That's KCUR Sam Zeff and Stephen Caranda of Kansas Public Radio. Thank you both very much. They've joined me for a very up-to-date version of State House Blend Kansas. As usual, you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow on the show, we'll preview the new home of the Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center, a live broadcast from that new center out there on Metcalf. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.